It's hard to find a home in politics if you're not a Democrat or Republican. There are smaller parties, of course, but it's usually an uphill climb, especially when the parties in power decide how big you need to be to get on the ballot.
The problem is finding that cutoff point where we say this party is serious and this other party is frivolous.
That's Libertarian Party of Illinois Chair Lex Green. We'll speak with him and Green Party Secretary Jeffrey Cubbage. Plus, Reverend Billy Graham died last week at age 99. Dr. Ed Stetzer from Wheaton College says Graham's legacy will be about more than partisan politics.
He sort of eventually pulled away from politics. I think his biggest contribution was that he reminded Christians that politics isn't the answer and no president is the savior. Ultimately, his focus was on telling people about Jesus, and Jesus changes everything.
But first, yesterday, the State House voted on a series of bills designed to strengthen gun control. We'll get the latest from reporter Daisy Contreras. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 2 weeks ago, 17 people died in a mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. But unlike many of the mass shootings over the years, the issue of gun control has stayed in the headlines in large part because high school students are taking it upon themselves to make sure lawmakers pay attention. We've talked on the program before with Illinois students about who are planning walkouts and who have already walked out of their high schools in protest. Gun control advocates, including Chicago's police superintendent and Cardinal Blaise Supich, have followed up on that with their own calls for action. Yesterday, here in Illinois, the Illinois House took a step in that direction by passing several bills designed to strengthen gun control. To explain all of this, I'm joined by NPR Illinois reporter Daisy Contreras. She's in the State House right now. Hi, Daisy. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me back.
Daisy, before we get to what's in these, this isn't the first time the State House has taken up gun control, but I want to ask you what the mood was like yesterday in the run-up to the vote. Would you think it was different at all from votes like this in the past because of the Florida shooting?
Yes. I mean, this isn't the first time the General Assembly has looked at the issue of gun control. Late last year, after the Las Vegas shooting, there were several calls here in the State House to ban bump stocks. That proposal kind of stalled, but just this week, as you said, several different bills were drafted or reintroduced. Those were in addition to two other proposals that were already in the works since last spring. So that made seven in total. So yes, definitely it felt different after the Florida shooting. The legislators I spoke to, gun control advocates, they all felt the need to use this momentum to act.
So there were a lot of different bills yesterday, Daisy. Can we clear up what was actually passed? Can we start with what's passed and what's awaiting the governor's signature?
Yes. So the bill that will be sent to the governor is one that requires gun dealers to be licensed under the state. Currently, gun dealers are licensed at the federal level, and there are no state-level requirements. But, you know, it's interesting. This is a proposal that has been in the works for about 15 years now. Many opponents of this week's so-called gun safety package said they felt most of these were all knee-jerk reactions to the recent mass shootings. But this one, the Gun Dealer Licensing Act, is one that's maybe not a reaction to those recent events. Yesterday, just this bill alone took up about 2 hours worth of debate for a vote. The Senate voted on it last April, but definitely momentum this week helped to get some Republicans on board in the House.
And Daisy, just to refresh my memory and listeners who may not be aware, up until this point, Illinois has not had, there's federal requirements for gun licensing, but Illinois as a state has not had any, correct?
Correct, yes.
So there were actually seven bills that were scheduled for votes, but a few actually made it in the end. We've talked about the licensing. You mentioned the bump stock ban. What else happened?
Yeah, so in addition to the Gun Dealer Licensing Act, there were three other bills, including the bump stock ban, that advanced, one, the House chamber, and they will now go into the Senate for further discussion. One of those prohibits anyone under 21 from purchasing military-style assault weapons, and another one looks at having a 72-hour wait period before selling or delivering assault weapons.
Daisy, did you see votes yesterday along party lines for this? How did the vote shape up on all of these?
Yeah, there was bipartisan support on several of these, but for the most part, yes, there was some type of rural-urban divide. Most of the Chicago area lawmakers voted in favor. We had some Democrats who were not in favor at all, and a lot of the Republican lawmakers were concerned that these were drafted too fast for their liking.
And what do we know about Governor Rauner? What has he said about gun control these past few weeks? Do we have any indication that he's going to sign at least that one bill that's been sent to his desk about the licensing?
Yeah, so it's interesting you say that. In the past, the governor has said he would rather see the federal government take up the issue of gun control and not have it be an issue that the state looks at. His office has said they will consider every bill lawmakers send the governor, but it's still unclear what his plans are for this one that will be sent to him pretty soon.
We will see. His Republican opponent in the primary, Jeannie Ives, we should point out, Daisy, she did vote against all of these bills. So I imagine there's a little also part of the campaign motivation that comes behind whether or not we'll see what the governor is going to say about this. I know you'll be keeping an eye on that. That's Daisy Contreras from Springfield, from the State House. She's a reporter with NPR Illinois. Daisy, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
If you've ever turned on cable news, you've seen that map of the U.S. with red and blue states, red for Republicans, blue for Democrats. And in this year's midterm election, the main political fight has been between these two parties, these two big parties, and who gets control of the House and Senate and statewide offices around the country. A reminder, yesterday we talked about how they're really shades of blue and red, and we still want to hear from you on that. If you go to our website at 21stshow.org, what you think the Republican and Democratic parties should stand for. But what if you've decided both of those parties are not for you? Well, you still have options. And today we're talking with members of two different parties in Illinois. I'm joined now by Lex Green, chair of the Libertarian Party of Illinois. He's at our studios of our partner station, WGLT in Bloomington Normal. Lex, thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me on.
Jeffrey Cubbage is also with us at our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. He's secretary of the Green Party of Illinois. Jeffrey, thanks for being with me as well.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Lex, let's start with we're going to talk about the Libertarian Party platform in a minute, but I wanted to start with actually a more personal question for you, because I think when we're growing up and learning about our country as kids, we see Democrats and Republicans on TV. We see them as presidents. Maybe our parents are members of those parties. At one point for you, did you look at the political system and say, I want to be involved in politics, but I don't want to be a member of either the Republican or Democratic Party? Did you always feel that way, or did something change?
No, I've always been that way. I think when I was it was post high school, I saw a survey in a newspaper that talked about being conservative and liberal or progressive, and I took that and I realized that the parties don't adhere to either of those types of ideologies. And at that point, I immediately started looking at all the options, and the Libertarian Party was always appealing to me.
Jeffrey, what about you? When did you decide the Green Party was going to be the right home for you?
I actually got my start in politics working for a Democratic legislator up in Wisconsin, and I had the experience of a primary where the outcome was a foregone conclusion. It was very much, I think, the experience that a lot of Bernie Sanders folks had this year, where I was backing a younger, more progressive, much more feminist, much more socialist-friendly candidate, and the older, more established Democrat in the primary was the one with all the connections, all the money, and everyone knew how it was going to go. And I think for me, as a first-time campaign volunteer, that was an enlightening moment, the realization that, well, okay, we think we have choice, we think we have democracy, but by the time you get to the voting booth, who's going to be on that ballot has already been determined for you. And I said, well, that's a terrible way to do this. I need a better option. And I started looking around, and that's how I found my way to the Green Party.
I want to ask you about that and the ballot and getting on the ballot in a little bit, but let me just get into what you all believe. And Jeffrey, I wonder if we can start with you, and if you can explain what you think the core values are of the Green Party of Illinois and why that's important to you.
Sure. So the Illinois Green Party and the Green Party of the United States are both governed by what they call their four pillars, and those are grassroots democracy, environmental wisdom, nonviolence, and social justice. And I think those broad categories are things that most people believe in one way or another. We can have our policy differences over how to best pursue those goals, but they're very universal goals. They seem to speak to a lot of people, and I was very happy to find a party that was willing to stand up and speak for those.
Lix, what about you? What does the Libertarian Party of Illinois stand for?
Well, we are based on the Non-Aggression Pact, which is basically we all agree that we shouldn't initiate aggression or force against other people to achieve our goals. But we also think that government should be held to that same standard, including all government officials, and that would be the best way to organize society and the most peaceful and prosperous.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if both of you can give me examples of how you think these principles can be applied to solve some of our state and our country's biggest problems. Jeffrey, can we start with you?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think the nonviolence pillar of the Green Party is a really good example because so much of what we use government for in the United States and so much of what we spend taxpayer money on are violent enterprises. It's the military at the state and local level. It's the police forces. And I don't think there's anyone in the country who can't think of some example of how that has harmed other human beings, you know. And the amount of resources we're wasting on doing all that harm could go to so many other things, could go to our schools, could go to our hospitals, could go to our roads, our infrastructure, our power supply, things like that. So that's very much front and center for the Green Party at every level, is how can we reprioritize our entire government away from these imperial and violent and military enterprises to peaceful, sustainable, community-serving enterprises.
Okay. And Lex, what about the Libertarian Party?
Well, actually, we agree what he just said, but I would add that we also apply those concepts of non-aggression and keeping your hands off to the economy as well. So the freest economy is going to be the one where the government has the fewest regulations and doesn't ask people who braid hair to get a license or scare businesses out of their state with the huge amount of taxes. So we agree with the peace abroad and peace at home, but we also think that regulation is just another form of government aggression.
And so, Lex, as you say that, I know that you all are actually in Bloomington right now. You're having a party convention to pick your nominee for governor. As you all look at that and the governor, the next governor you'd like to see leading the state of Illinois, how does the Libertarian Party reconcile this notion of kind of staying away from taxes and the fiscal state that we're in Illinois? Is that something that you all are debating as you're thinking about who you're picking as your next candidate for governor?
Well, it does make debates difficult because we all are unified in thinking that we are way overtaxed in Illinois, and it's very easy to attack the existing government in Illinois for doing just the opposite of what we've suggested. And certainly spending is the flip side of that same coin, which you will not hear the Republicans or the Democrats talking about. They want to keep spending more and more and then tax less and less. Well, the Republicans want to tax less and less, which is disingenuous. So we are certainly going to hear lots of rhetoric at the convention about lowering taxes, but also solutions that include lowering spending.
We're talking third parties here in Illinois with Lex Green. He's chair of Illinois' Libertarian Party. Jeffrey Cubbage is with us as well. He's secretary of the Green Party of Illinois. If you're listening and you're a member of either of these parties and want to chime in or join our conversation, you're always welcome. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. That's our handle, 21st Show. And gentlemen, let me ask both of you, as you all look at the landscape of this past year and you look at the amount of Democrats and the unprecedented number of women who are now running for office and feeling very energized by the current state of politics and wanting to change it, I wonder if, Jeffrey, if I can start with you with the Green Party, are you seeing a same level of increased interest or engagement within the Green Party?
Yes, very much. And I would take that all the way back to, you know, mid-2016, even early 2016 during the Democrat primaries is when we first started seeing this big upsurge in membership, and it spiked after the Democratic National Convention. You know, there were a lot of people who had that experience of saying, this isn't fair, this isn't how I want to choose candidates, what are my other options? And a lot of those came to us. So 2017 was a growth year. You know, we opened about 15 new chapters statewide, got a lot of people on the ground, and, you know, are now turning that into electoral energy for the 2018 season.
Do you guys have numbers, Jeffrey, of how many people are registered with the Green Party or how many people are working with you all?
So we can give you a rough idea. Illinois is not a partisan registration state. The Board of Elections does not register your party. So party membership, quote unquote, is just an internal record that each party keeps for itself. We have about 3,500 members statewide. And then certainly whenever there is a Green Party primary ballot available, a number of people who are not on that list end up pulling it. But because of Illinois' ballot access laws, which I think we are going to get into later, you said, we don't always have the option for our members to pull a primary ballot. So it is hard to get an exact number of where all that support is in the state.
I do want to get to ballot access. We're going to have to do that after the break, but we've got about a minute before the break. And Lex, I just wanted to ask you about libertarian interest, if you're seeing a renewed amount of interest as well this election cycle.
Absolutely. We've been seeing a renewed interest since the 2008 Ron Paul efforts, even though he wasn't he ran as a Republican. But we've also seen a steady increase in interest over the time. And as was pointed out, we may have about 3,500 to 4,000 people who have actually signed up on our website, but we've had almost 200,000 people vote for our candidates across the state in the last several elections. So that's a bit better indication of how we're growing.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation and to get to this issue of ballot access. I know both of you want to talk about that, and I want to get into what it actually takes to get on the ballot in Illinois. Hear some of, I imagine, your frustrations with that. We're speaking to the Green and Libertarian parties of Illinois. We'll continue this conversation with Lex Green and Jeffrey Cubbage just on the other side of this short break. By the way, as always, you're welcome to tweet your comments or questions to us. Our handle's 21STShow. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're discussing third parties with the Libertarian Party of Illinois and the Green Party of Illinois. The Libertarian Party of Illinois is actually meeting right now in Bloomington to elect their candidate for governor. We've got the chair, Lex Green, with us from our partner stations, WGLT in Normal, on the line from our studios in Evanston at Northwestern University is Jeffrey Cubbage. He's secretary of the Green Party of Illinois. And I want to bring a third person into this conversation. Brian Gaines is in studio with me here in Illinois. He teaches political science at the University of Illinois. He's also with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Brian, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being here as well.
Always glad to be here.
As we talk about ballot access, Jeffrey, I should actually point out you're running. You're a candidate for the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago, right?
Yes, thank you very much. And that's actually an even weirder ballot access situation than most in Illinois.
Is that a partisan position to be on the Water Reclamation District? Do you have to declare a party?
Yes, it is. It is a partisan election. You run as either a Democrat or Republican, Green or Libertarian, if you can get on the ballot as those. But for the past more than 20 years, it has been an all-Democrat board.
And so how hard was it for you to get on the ballot as a Green Party member?
So the answer to that gets very complicated. It is one of the areas where we are an established party, which means we play by the same rules as Democrats and Republicans, which is fairly unusual for an alternate party in Illinois. So we have five candidates for that board this year, and four of them were able to get on the ballot with a relatively modest number of signatures. I'm the fifth candidate, and I am actually running in a write-in only primary to fill a vacancy. There was a commissioner who died in office towards the end of the filing period, and so the Cook County clerk said, if you want to be on the ballot in November, The only way you can do that is to run in your party's primary as a write-in candidate, and there are a minimum number of votes for that. So the Green Party will need 1,720 write-in votes for Jeffrey Cubbage in the March primary to have a candidate on the November ballot for that fifth seat.
So do you need write-in votes from the Green Party or write-in votes from anyone?
No, they must be on the Green Party ballot. So we have to convince voters to pull the Green Party primary ballot rather than a Democrat, a Republican, or a nonpartisan referenda-only ballot and do the write-in on that ballot.
Well, Brian Gaines, that seems like a tall order. I wonder if that's, you think, emblematic of the way that the system is set up in Illinois, if it's particularly difficult in Illinois for third-party candidates.
It is. That's an excellent example of just how incredibly complicated American elections are as well. The fact that we have the primary elections and then the general elections already makes us rather unusual that they're both public elections governed by largely by state law, not by federal law, but with some federal law intruding. Generally, that try to not to wade into all the nitty-gritty. Illinois is one of the more difficult states in the country to have to mount a write-in candidacy, an independent candidacy, or to be a party other than the Republicans and Democrats. There's this distinction in law between established parties and new parties. Maintaining the status of an established party is difficult for the smaller parties, and it's I don't think Illinois is the most difficult, but it's certainly in the top 10, maybe even the top 5 in the number of barriers, the number of signatures you have to collect, the performance you need in the general election in order to maintain the status of an established party, whether the signatures have to be collected just statewide or in local districts. Across all of these dimensions, Illinois makes it pretty hard to be a third party.
And Brian, I imagine you would, many people who are listening might be thinking that's because of how entrenched the Democratic Party has been in Illinois. And it's sort of perhaps, I don't know if you would say it's been in the interest of the Democratic Party of Illinois to make it difficult for anyone else to ever get on the ballot.
I wouldn't disagree with that characterization that this is a very Democratic, very blue state. But it isn't as predictable as you might think. The states that make it hardest on minor party candidates aren't systematically the ones that are the most safe. You would think then maybe heavily Republican states, Idaho and Utah, and heavily Democratic states, Maryland and Illinois, those must be the ones. It's not really that simple. The mix of states, for example, California, Vermont, New Jersey, Michigan, they're all pretty comparatively friendly to minor parties. And those are not, the paradigmatic purple states, Florida, Ohio, the ones that kind of lean both ways.
Lex, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation. Lex Green is chair of the Libertarian Party of Illinois. We heard Brian and Jeffrey mention this whole idea of an established party. Can you explain what the threshold is for you all to get a candidate on the ballot for governor? That's actually what you all are doing right now in Bloomington.
Right. The law specifies that we have to get 5% of all votes cast for a particular office, but luckily for statewide offices, it's capped at 25,000 signatures. Once you get 25,000 signatures successfully surviving challenges by anybody in the state who wishes to challenge a signature, then you can be put on the ballot. But we have to also go through an arduous defense. So we generally collect between 40 and 50,000 signatures to cover people who've moved or who didn't register but signed anyway. And so it's a very big hill to climb.
And how do you all, what's the process that you all are going through right now to pick your nominee for governor?
Well, that's very interesting because we're very happy to be in this situation as a new party because we control our ticket. We get to choose our candidates. You don't have a situation like the Republicans do in a third Congress where a Nazi is the only Republican running, and anybody could run as a Republican there, but only a Nazi is running. That wouldn't happen for us right now. However, as we become successful and we become an established party in Illinois, the problem is going to be not only do we lose a little control over who our candidates are, but then we also have to go to a primary system that is funded by taxpayers. It's basically a lot of public relations funded by taxpayers instead of the private selection process through conventions, which we would prefer.
Right. And Lex, just a note for our audience, if those you're referring to the 3rd Congressional District, that's the candidate for the Republican Party who's running against. It's a very interesting primary situation with the incumbent Dan Lipinski and Marie Newman, who's putting up a challenge to him there in that 3rd Congressional District. On ballot access, Jeffrey, I wanted to ask you how you'd like to see the laws in Illinois change. I don't know if you think I think whether or not that will happen is a whole other question. But what would you like to see happen, Jeffrey, in terms of ballot access and third parties?
I mean, I think the simplest and fairest solution that just about any voter would agree upon is there should be one set of rules for all candidates, regardless of your partisan affiliation, regardless of whether you're independent. You should jump through the same hoops to get on the ballot. Everyone who's on the ballot should have done an equal amount of work to get there. Now, idealistically, I mean, talking in a perfect world, the Green Party is a party that favors public funding of elections, ultimately favors proportional representation rather than first past the post districts. So there are a lot of reforms we could do to make things more democratic. But just within the system that we currently have, the obvious starting place is equal ballot access requirements for all candidates for any given office.
Brian, does that happen in other states?
It happens selectively. It's not typical. Generally, the states that are most favorable to minor parties have different requirements, but they're not sort of by order of magnitude a factor of 10 as it is in Illinois. Once you're an established party, the signatures requirements are much lower.
Brian, I think people who are listening might be interested in why our system is so complex, and if there's a simple answer to why we have such a complex electoral process in this country.
There's not a simple answer. One ingredient is that it's heavily federal. Really, the United States and Switzerland are almost alone in the degree to which election rules are set locally rather than nationwide. So there's a lot of diversity across the 50 states, and there's even quite a bit of diversity within states in the local implementation of election law. As I say, Switzerland is like this. Not many other countries are. I think the other important thing is the depth of democracy in the United States, that so many offices are elected. That also is unusual. It's unusual that so many of these offices are partisan. That also sort of cuts into this discussion in that there's only one nonpartisan state legislature. There are nonpartisan city governments, but there's an awful lot of party elections for offices where you wouldn't necessarily expect parties. Water reclamation
district. Like the Water Reclamation District, right. That's Ryan Gaines. He teaches political science at the University of Illinois. He's also with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Jeffrey Cubbage, Secretary of the Green Party of Illinois, is with us, along with Lex Green, who's chair of the Libertarian Party. Jeffrey, the Green Party isn't running a governor candidate, but I understand there are members of the city council in Chicago who are members of your party. There's a Green Party member running for, not in Chicago, but other city councils. I understand there's also a Green Party member running for Congress in the 12th district. And do you also have a state representative candidate as well?
Yes. And, you know, the question, do you have a candidate, falls into this timeline that parties where they are not established don't actually get to become ballot certified candidates until the end of their petition gathering period. And that won't happen until the end of June. So, you know, who is an official Green Party candidate won't be a settled question until roughly the start of July, almost, you know, less than 4 months before election.
Jeffrey, is it frustrating for you to mobilize support and try to get your message out there as a smaller party when you have these two giant institutions that are running everything?
Yes, it is very much always. But I think the most frustrating aspect is, in a lot of ways, that electoral calendar that, you know, the Democrat and Republican parties know who their candidates are and are actively campaigning more than a year before Election Day. And then right in the middle of the height of campaign season, you know, that March through the end of June window, third parties have to stop everything they're doing and throw all their resources into the petition gathering process. And it's very hard to do that and run an effective outreach campaign at the same time. So that's been a perennial challenge for us. And that's why we do better in areas where we have become established, like the 12th Congressional District and the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District.
And Lex, for you all, when you think about the money in this campaign with the billionaires that we have running in both the Democrat and the Republican Party, how much do you think that calculates into your level of frustration about getting the word out?
Well, it is frustrating because every little bit of advertising affects voters' choice. And when we're spending all of our money just trying to get the petitions and then defend them in the courts or defend them at the State Board of Elections and so on until August, and billionaires are buying commercials all over the state. Yeah, our name recognition is very small by design, by the design of the law, and the fact that we need to be a billionaire to be president or a billionaire or multimillionaire to be governor is really concerning to me anyway.
Brian, when we look at elections, and I'm just to Jeffrey's point about having a year, part of me also wonders how many voters are actually paying attention that far out. I think as people like myself who are journalists or people who are very highly invested in politics are maybe paying attention. But I even wonder, I mean, we're actually 20 days from the primary, we're 19 days from the primary today. I feel like now is maybe when, if people are going to pay attention, they are paying attention. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, with the qualification that a lot of people are not interested enough in politics to pay attention to a primary, really it's the general election
right.
that draws people in. Presidential general elections are the kind of peak of interest, and a lot of people sit those out. They don't find them that interesting. So it's always a good idea to remember that if you are a political junkie and you're inherently interested in these things and care a lot about them, that you're in the minority, that a lot of people regard politics as an intrusion on daily lives. They're willing to tolerate a little bit, but they're not going to get sucked up into the campaigns, you know, even a primary campaign, except by a lot of activity.
Let me start, Lex, by asking you, and Jeffrey, I want to pose this question to you as well. There's always kind of the spoiler argument with a third party, right? There are people who are listening thinking, okay, it's great your principles that you have as a Green Party member or a Libertarian Party, but all you're really doing is siphoning off votes from the Democratic or Republican Party, and you're messing up elections. And people will say, look at what happened with President Trump, or the Democrats will say, look at what happened with President Trump, and or Democrats will say, look at what happened with the 2000 election with Ralph Nader and saying you helped Republicans win. Lex, do you think that's a fair criticism?
No, it ignores reality. I mean, no election has the same number of voters as an election before or after. And the assumption that people who came out to vote for a Libertarian or for a Green Party candidate would have voted at all, or let alone for a Democrat or Republican, is just speculation. And in my view, if I'm a spoiler and I cause one of the other two candidates to lose, I've actually done half my job. My goal is to get them both to lose. So I think the spoiler argument, again, is just not based on reality. It's just a ploy by the two major parties to get people to vote for them.
Jeffrey?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And to it, I would add a couple of things. First, Illinois specific, we have a huge problem in Illinois with uncontested general election races. In any given year at the statehouse level, about a third of those elections are uncontested in the general. There's a lack of democracy going on there. And down to the municipal level, there are literally city offices that have a hard time finding candidates at all. They can't fill all the seats because there aren't enough people interested in running. So in races like that, a third party is a boon. It's at least one other way for people to get involved and for people to run and make these into contested elections. And then, you know, just broadly speaking at the statewide level or even the nationwide level, yeah, the idea that, all right, the spoiler argument came against the Greens first, what, back in 2000 with Ralph Nader. That's when you first really started hearing it. If the Democratic Party is that concerned about this problem, and 18 years later, they still can't win an election unless the Green Party ceases to exist. What the heck have they been doing for the last 18 years? You know, their political strategy needs some updating if we're still a threat almost 20 years after they realized that this was a possibility.
Brian, what about that point? Just statistically to what Lex said, is there a way to know? There isn't a way for us to know, is there, if people would have voted for, if a Green vote would have been a Democratic vote or a Libertarian vote would have been a Republican vote, is there a way for us to know that?
Academics spend a lot of time and spill a lot of ink on this, and we can survey people and ask them who they would have voted for and get one estimate. The Florida 2000 case is interesting because those ballots were subjected to so much scrutiny. The people who voted for Ralph Nader were not, by and large, people who voted Democrat straight down the ballot. They weren't people with donkeys tattooed to their arms who just cast that one deviating vote. They voted for Republicans and Democrats, and they skipped races, and they voted for third or minor party candidates when they had the chance. So I think it is grating, for the supporters of a minor party, but for almost anyone to hear this sort of entitlement attitude. The major parties have the entitlement to have a race without the distraction of other parties. That's clearly not in the public interest. There's some argument in the public interest for having a relatively uncluttered ballot and not having a tremendous proliferation of parties. There's evidence from other countries of just how confusing that can be. But it's very hard to make some kind of a normative argument that the only thing that's fair is for the voters to get the simplest of all races with just a reap and a dem. And as the other guest pointed out, we have probably 50%, not even 1/3 of the races uncontested in statewide races, the state house or state. And so it's very
always
hard to justify
good to
those.
Have, right, as many candidates as possible running. I want to thank Brian Gaines for being with me here in Urbana. He's at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Jeffrey Cubbage from Chicago, he's Secretary of the Green Party of Illinois. Lex Green from Normal, Chair of the Libertarian Party. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks so much for having us on.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting Organizing with Love in a Time of Hate, March 6th at 4 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. Author, activist, and thought leader Ai-Jen Poo will speak about the current political climate and the potential for change. cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tomorrow, Reverend Billy Graham will be buried at a private family service in Charlotte, North Carolina. He died last week at age 99. He's been called America's greatest pastor, and for the past few days, his body has been lying inside the rotunda of the Capitol building in Washington. Billy Graham's just one of four private citizens in the United States history to be given that honor. Here in Illinois, his death is being felt especially intensely in the town of Wheaton, a suburb west of Chicago. Billy Graham graduated from Wheaton College in 1943. The Christian school opened the Billy Graham Center in 1981. The Wheaton College community is holding its own public memorial to honor Reverend Graham with a service tomorrow morning. It will include a live stream of the official memorial from Charlotte, as well as a performance by Wheaton's concert choir. We're going to tweet out information to that at our website, 21stshow.org. But we want to spend some time today talking about Billy Graham's legacy here in Illinois. To do that, I'm joined now by Wheaton College's chaplain, Tim Blackman. Reverend Blackman, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much for having us.
Joel Carpenter is also with us. He's director of the Nagel Institute for the Study of World Christianity at Calvin College. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out now that Calvin College is one of my alma maters. Joel, it's great to have you on the show today as well.
And mine
yes,
too,
actually.
Oh, and yours too. Okay, so we've got lots of Calvin College grads on the air today. Reverend Blackman, how keenly is Reverend Graham's loss being felt at Wheaton right now?
Oh, tremendous. I mean, he has certainly been a towering figure in the history of Wheaton College. I mean, a few years ago when the Billy Graham Center here was dedicated, he indicated when he was back on campus that it was here at Wheaton that he received a new spiritual challenge and an intellectual perspective that influenced his entire ministry. And I think that that relationship was entirely reciprocated. I mean, we were very fond of him, and certainly he was deeply indebted to his education here.
And in fact, Reverend Blackman, Reverend Graham actually majored in anthropology at Wheaton. How do you think that impacted his worldview?
You know, this is very interesting. In a 1986 interview with Parade magazine, he was actually asked, when looking back over his life at age 86 at the time, if he would have done anything differently. And he said this, I wish I had gotten more education. If I could have, I would have gotten a PhD in anthropology to understand the race situation in this country better. And it was actually Wheaton's own Brian Howell, the anthropologist on our campus, who pointed this out to me. And it was interesting that while he studied anthropology here, not only was he exposed to interracial classrooms for the first time, which was certainly in the early 40s a rarity as a Southerner, but it was also that his anthropological training really influenced his views on race, and leading really first to his vocal, you know, if initially inconsistent, opposition to legal segregation. But it really colored his entire public engagement, not only with race and segregation, but also how he viewed politics and his understanding of humankind. And a lot of that was he's deeply indebted to his study of anthropology here.
And I want to get into some of that a little bit in a minute. But Joel, I wanted to just ask you, as Reverend Blackman was just mentioning, Billy Graham was from the South. He grew up in North Carolina. How did he end up in Chicago?
Well, he was a student at the Florida Bible Institute when he ran into President Edmund, Raymond Edmund, who is had just become president of Wheaton College. And somehow the young man impressed Edmund. He said, "You should come up to our place." So Billy took him up on that and enrolled at Wheaton in 1940.
Wow. And so in 1940, as we think about this, Reverend Blackman, you were talking about being in integrated classrooms. I wanted to just ask about that legacy. As you said, inconsistent in the beginning, which certainly is pretty well documented, but I think Billy Graham really did broaden the evangelical Christian movement in terms of opening the door for African Americans in particular. What do you think that meant? I wonder how that you feel like that is influenced, that influence continues today, not just in the broader evangelical movement, but also for Wheaton College.
Yeah, well, I think certainly we know for a fact from Martin Luther King's perspective that it was actually Billy Graham's influence on the desegregation of the Billy Graham Crusades that Martin Luther King said that Billy Graham had actually done more for the cause of civil rights than anyone else, and so there you really see that for American evangelicals, Billy Graham became a person who showed that the gospel of Jesus Christ had tremendous implications for our life together and for healing America's wound. And this became, I think, a significant part of his legacy. And I think initially, although he was somewhat inconsistent, you know, even in 1999, he went on record saying that he believed that the America's racial wound was the single most detrimental thing to our life together.
Professor Carpenter, I wonder if you could weigh in here just in terms of Billy Graham and his legacy, particularly when we think about the civil rights movement.
Sure. Well, I think moving to a different venue really did make a difference for him. But I think in some respects his Southern rearing did as well. You know, it pushed people in different directions. Some became arch segregationists, but Billy recalled living on a dairy farm. He had there were black employees. He ate with them. He played with their kids, and so it was not like people of other races were strange to him at all. When he came to Wheaton, he ran into people from literally from all over the world, including his wife Ruth. Ruth Bell, who was a missionary kid. Her parents are serving in China, and she'd been educated as well in Korea. And so as well as, you know, his formal studies in anthropology, he was rubbing shoulders with people with a lot broader acquaintance of the world.
Professor Carpenter, I want to ask you, Reverend Graham started preaching in Western Springs at First Baptist in 1943. He wasn't there very long, but can you tell us about his time there?
Right. So he came to Wheaton as a preacher boy, and that's what he wanted to do. And every weekend he was preaching. A bunch of students had actually founded a gospel tabernacle in Wheaton. And They would also go downtown and preach. My father was shipping out for overseas during the war in 1943, and there were a couple of preachers in the corner of Union Station, and lo and behold, it was Billy Graham and Grady Wilson, two Wheaton students. So that was really on his heart to do, and he was noticed by some local lay leaders of this church startup in Western Springs, and they said, "Would you come and be our pastor?" So he did, he wasn't there long before other leading pastors, evangelists, creative ministry folk in Chicago discovered him. And so by 1944, still at the church, but he was asked to take over a radio program called Songs in the Night. So he was able to preach on the radio too, and that's when he met George Beverly Shea, who was at the time a staff soloist at WMBI, Moody Bible Institute's radio station. And so he persuaded George, shall we say, to join him on this late night radio program. So yeah, he hit the ground wanting to preach, and he had found plenty of opportunities in Chicago. It was a very creative cauldron for evangelical things back then.
I'm speaking with Joel Carpenter. He's director of the Nagel Institute for the Study of World Christianity at Calvin College, and Reverend Tim Blackman. He's Wheaton College's chaplain, about the legacy of Reverend Billy Graham. We have some audio, actually, from the Billy Graham Association of part of a sermon that he gave in 1952 in Western Springs.
Yesterday, the representatives of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization voted to spend $300 billion to provide an adequate defense to any attack by Soviet Russia on Western Europe. A few days ago, it was my privilege to tell members of the Armed Services Committee that this is not enough. We must implement our financial and military program with a spiritual and moral program if Western Europe and the Western world is to survive. It is now clearly evident that the half-forgotten Korean War is becoming an international political football. 3,000 American prisoners are being used as hostages to compel us to compromise point by point at the armistice table. But one of the thrilling things about this war is the work of God among the 167,000 communist prisoners we're holding in South Korea.
That's audio from the Billy Graham Association of a sermon from 1950. That's a sermon from 1952, actually. I want to get into the politics of that, but Chaplain Reverend Blackman, when you hear that, I wonder what your reaction is. Was that, do you think, emblematic of his style?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, he is clear, and since his earliest days, he's always been an impassioned speaker. It's also interesting that this audio clip is from 1952, and I'm not sure exactly when he said this, but I remember reading in our archives that he said, if I had to do it over again, I would avoid any semblance of involvement in partisan politics. An evangelist is called to do one thing and one thing only, to proclaim the gospel. Becoming involved in strictly political issues or partisan politics dilutes the evangelist's impact and compromises his message. And you even hear in that audio clip that there is an interest in talking to the things that concern his American audience, but also a sense that he needs something on a different plane, on a spiritual plane, that is really his primary focus as an evangelist.
And Joel, when when they hear what Reverend Blackman's saying, I think they might be surprised, because I think people associate Billy Graham. People often mention he was a spiritual advisor to presidents. People see him as someone who played a big role in bringing, in creating, in some ways, the evangelical political movement. Would you agree with that, Joel?
Well, I don't think that was his intention, but it was constantly something that attracted him. When presidents would ask him to come for advice, to pray with them, et cetera, or even ask his opinion about current affairs. I think his singular purpose, he would always say, was to preach the gospel and to invite people to come to Christ. But he did that in a way that always spoke into contemporary affairs. He said, I want to preach with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other hand. So he said, we want to speak to what people are feeling about today, what concerns them. And of course, it was a crisis-filled time. So he had plenty of grist for that.
And I wonder, Joel, how you think he would look at politics today and how religion is discussed, if there's a way you think he would look at that.
Well, I think we have some clues to that when 15, 20 years ago, we see the rise of the religious right, and even earlier than that, and he really demurred from getting involved in it. He said to Jerry Falwell, Sr. and others, I think this is the wrong way to go. So he was constantly attracted to getting more involved in political things. He often did. Later in his life, as Tim says, he came to regret it. I don't think the politicization of the evangelical movement is really what he had in mind.
And Reverend Blackman, I wanted to ask you about students today. And I imagine at Wheaton College, Reverend Graham is remembered more for his spirituality and his preaching than the politics.
Yeah, I think that's right. And certainly the students who are now 18 to, you know, to 22 years old really don't have the same kind of emotive connection that either their parents or their grandparents would have. But it's interesting, yesterday in one of our chapel services, we actually showed a video clip from the 1952 and 1953 crusades in Mississippi and in Tennessee, when the black participants in the crusade were separated by ropes from the white audience. And in fact, the white audience could sit in the front and the blacks had to sit in the back. And Billy insisted that they remove those barriers. In fact, he went to talk to the head usher. He says, "You got to remove these." The head usher refused to do it and actually resigned on the spot when they found out that Billy Graham was very clear. He says, "No, I'm not going to preach. We're not going to go through with this service unless you remove those barriers." And it's interesting to see how our students, although they don't really know the global impact of having preached to hundreds of millions of people of Billy Graham, I think they resonate deeply with the kind of courage and consistency and clarity that he already had in the early 1950s.
Yeah, and I'm afraid we'll have to leave it at that, Reverend Blackman. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But thanks for being with us. That's Wheaton College chaplain Tim Blackman. We'll have information on our website about all of the services that are happening tomorrow. I want to thank Reverend Blackman, Joel Carpenter with Calvin College's Nagel Institute for the Study of World Christianity. That does it for us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.